The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Weekend, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. And today, our special guest on this show, as we always try and keep it informative and up-to-date and what's interesting, of course, for all of you out there, is Natalie Southwick. Now, Natalie claims to have the voice of a 12-year-old when she's on the radio, but I will tell you now that she is not 12. This is a very practiced journalist with a wealth of experience under her belt, and she'll be talking to us today about her new project as the editor-in-chief of the Latin Correspondent, a new news website out there, perhaps reporting on pieces of news, items of news that are not reported or covered in the mainstream media. And of course, as we have the internet as a vast platform, it's all about getting the message out there. If you want to hear the real news, if you want to read the real news, if you want to get past the mainstream media, you can find ways. You are not confined to watching the news on your TV. You can find it on the internet. So there are quality journalists out there submitting articles about stories that need to be told about our world, and in particular here in Colombia and, of course, in South America. So Natalie is the editor-in-chief of the Latin Correspondent. Very easy to find, latincorrespondent.com. Get in touch with her, of course, if you are a writer, a journalist based in South America, South or Central America even, and you can submit articles there. They pay as well, which is always good in this current climate as a journalist. So we'll be talking about that, and I know that Natalie has done a lot of work as a sort of human rights sort of social projects coordinator here in Colombia, so we're going to get a chance to talk to her as well about her particular projects. Now, I know she has a certain love for the Pacific Coast and Buenaventura. Buenaventura is a city which really has very little good news coming out of it, and we'll be talking to Natalie about her experiences there and about the realities of Buenaventura in the Colombian context and as a regional, major regional port and commerce hub in Colombia. So it's very important to know something about Buenaventura and the, sort of, let's say, overlooked Pacific Coast. So we'll be coming right back with Natalie Southwick, a journalist with a vast amount of experience under her belt and great editorial line for her new project, which is Latin Correspondent. So we'll be coming back. We're going to take a short break. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Rich McCall. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, 2,600 meters closer to the stars here in Bogota, Colombia. Every week we have a special guest on the show, and this week it's the turn of Natalie Southwick. She's a native of Boston and a graduate of Northwestern. She's a journalist here in Colombia, and also she has worked in various human rights projects. So it's good to get someone in on the show talking about, you know, perhaps things that don't make the mainstream media out there about Colombia. That's the idea. We're going to uncover some myths, some truths. We're going to chat about her life. Natalie, welcome on the show.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Now, Natalie, how is it that you came to be in Colombia? You arrived in January 2012. We're now into 2014. You're still here. What are you doing?
Well, my parents ask me that pretty much every time we talk, actually. But I had a bit of a quarter life crisis. Coming out of college, I moved back to Boston. I was living there for about a year doing AmeriCorps, and kind of had this moment where I felt like I was getting way too comfortable.
Yeah.
And I was going to wake up one morning and be 30 and have, you know, matching bath towels and a set of souffle dishes or something, and that made me very anxious. So I decided the way to deal with that was by moving abroad. And a friend and I had spoken about maybe teaching abroad. We were working in a school at the time. I knew a guy who had done this program called World Teach, which sends volunteers abroad. They're in about 20, almost two dozen countries right now. And I checked it out, thought it looked interesting. They were in five different Spanish-speaking countries, and of those, Colombia was the most appealing. So I kind of sent my application, and they got back to me, accepted me, and I asked them kindly not to send me somewhere hot, and I ended up in Bogota.
It's not hot here.
No, it is not. This is a mistake that a lot of people make. My friends that have come to visit will assume that they should be bringing shorts and flip-flops, which, if you want people to notice that you're a tourist, is the best way to do it. But people don't really seem to know that Bogota is, in fact, basically October.
We're Andean, and it's chilly, and it's
a mountain.
On a mountain, and anything can happen within minutes, the truth. I mean, that's the thing. So, so your only request was to not go somewhere hot. Well, fair enough.
Well, but they give you a little bit of a choice. You get to say city or campo, essentially, and I've always been a city person, so I said, put me in a big city, put me somewhere cold, and there's not really that many options.
Nice. And so this was successful, your period teaching then?
I loved it. I'd been working in a middle school in the U.S. the year before in Boston, which is pretty much the most challenging situation you can be in, short of boot camp, I think. So coming in here, where at least the students at my school were extremely well behaved, very polite, you know, some of them slept through English class, but that's kind of how teenagers are. I really, really enjoyed being there. I had a wonderful time.
That's fantastic. And then from there, you've moved. Well, I mean, you've always been a journalist, because I know that you've worked at the Boston Globe. That's a very strong background in journalism to have at the Boston Globe. So you've been reporting for a variety of media outlets from Columbia. So tell us a little bit about it.
Well, while I was teaching, I really wanted to kind of keep my foot in the door, because I had gotten scolded by people at the Globe, actually, for going to do AmeriCorps, God forbid, trying to do something helpful for the community. Not that journalism isn't, but, you know, it was kind of a different area to be in for a little while. But I wanted to keep that skill set, and so I was writing a little bit for a site called Go Overseas that started out as kind of like study abroad advice and has since morphed into, they're doing a lot more of meaningful travel writing, kind of thinking really about people that want to do volunteering and teaching abroad in a sustainable way and not just a vacation. So that was one. I've also been writing for a site called Only in South America, which is actually run more or less affiliated with LAN Airlines.
Okay.
They have six different countries in South America that they highlight, and I'm the sort of country expert for Colombia, as it were.
Nice.
And just kind of picking up a few odd jobs along the way, going out and pitching, which is always fun. It's, you know, constant rejection, which is good for, I guess, the dating world, you know. You get used to it after a while. But, and then since about July of this year, I've been working on a website called Latin Correspondent.
And the Latin Correspondent, of which I have now submitted a piece for.
Yes, that's right. You're one of our contributors.
Latin Correspondent is a new venture, but it's expansive. It's covering every single country in Latin America. I've seen stuff from Guatemala, from Puerto Rico, from Brazil. How did you get this? How are you managing so many journalists?
Coffee. There was some report that came out recently that said that journalists drink more. We're the profession that drinks the most coffee.
Yeah, I saw that,
you know,
too.
And I figured, living in Colombia, it's like there's no hope. I mean, we already are over-caffeinated. But I think it's, you know, just that I'm really interested in staying up to speed on what's happening. Not only, obviously, I'm really immersed in the news here in Colombia, and that's really important to me, but I think it's also crucial to kind of have a sense of what's going on regionally. And I've been able to find some really quality journalists that are working in Mexico and Guatemala and Brazil, in a lot of countries that, you know, have a much stronger grasp on what's actually going on there because they live there. And so I've just been very lucky to have these contributors that are really helping look at the political world and corruption in the government and racism in football and all sorts of other topics that maybe don't make it into most English language news, because that's really what we're trying to do at this site is differentiate ourselves. The site is in English, but the hope is that it will appeal to an international English-speaking audience as well as people within these countries that have some knowledge of English, and that really gets the news really gets beyond, you know, drug cartels and violence and kidnapping and, you know, Argentina's economy going into the tank, because that's really all that we see for the most part.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. And I think it's important. And I mean, and of course, we've got this platform of so many journalists out here and all looking for work. We're always looking for work.
Always
looking for work. And I always say,
if anyone's listening and wants to hire us,
well, I was going to say, get in touch. Look up the website. It's latincorrespondent.com and you'll be informed. But it's a really nice, it's a very clear website. It's on that Quark, is it?
It's kind of like Quartz. It's set up in a way that's similar to Quartz.
Yeah, and it's easy to read. It's very clear. The titles are clear. It's not cluttered with let's say, in-depth. I mean, I'm not saying in-depth. It doesn't look like an academic document, which is important.
Well, one of our goals with this site, and this is really the design team more than anyone else. I can take credit for it, but I had nothing to do with the layout. Other than changing some titles. But one of our intentions was knowing that a very significant part of this audience that we're looking for accesses the internet via their phones, and mobile is the main way that people are getting a lot of information, especially in a lot of Latin American countries. So we really wanted to make something that was as accessible as possible for people, whether they were using a tablet, a desktop, a mobile device, and it looks the same essentially across all those platforms. So that was something that was really important for us to be able to reach that audience.
I'm particularly happy to see a friend of mine, Julie Schweitert Coyasso, up there contributing. It's someone I met first time here in Colombia when she came down, and we've been in touch, and she sort of feeds me articles, and I hopefully put her in contact with people. It's nice to see this community of like-minded, let's say, altruistic souls when
right.
it comes to journalism. So, well, long may it last. And how long? I mean, you've been on this for a few months, and it's got to be exciting to be part of something new.
It is really exciting. I mean, I feel like there's a lot of space for this kind of content. I've gotten really positive response, particularly from the contributors. There are a lot of people that are very excited about stories that they want to pitch and stories that they feel like aren't getting covered. And so it sort of makes my life a little easier, because they're the ones coming to me and saying, I have this idea, I want to write about the free cities in Honduras, for example,
yeah.
which is something that I am dying to find out more about and feel like is not getting a lot of coverage, at least in kind of a critical sense. And I have a woman who's working on some stories. She was just in Honduras for a couple months, and so she has a really strong knowledge of what's going on there. So I think that there's a lot of space for this kind of reporting and these kinds of stories that aren't appearing in English language media, at least. There are people doing good work, obviously, in Spanish and Portuguese, but that's maybe not crossing over to the English audience.
But it's not. I mean, you know, the language barrier is,
exactly.
is there. I mean, if I talk on...
We can't all be bilingual.
Yeah, talk on behalf of English people who don't speak any other languages out there, they're not going to follow this up. But it's very exciting. It's good. And to have these extra resources out there, and I mean, just give us an idea of a couple of the articles that have come out recently that you have been particularly happy with.
I would say that, well, we have one contributor, Anna Bevan, who's in Guatemala. She's actually from the UK as well, and she had a story recently about an effort to develop a bilingual hospital. That's one thing that they've had. That's also certainly an issue here in Colombia, and I think a lot of countries that have a significant indigenous population is that the indigenous population doesn't necessarily speak Spanish, and certainly not medical Spanish, and so people have a very difficult time accessing health services. There's a lot of distrust, and there's one hospital in particular she focuses on that's made an effort to make the services there bilingual, to have interpreters, particularly in the maternity ward, which is obviously crucial for women's health and how that's really made a lot more people feel more comfortable going there and tapping into these health services that are available.
This is a phenomenal story. I actually remember reading this. Now, I lived in Guatemala back in 1998-1999. It's quite a long time ago now.
It's been a little while.
But that was in that period where they were having the referendum to see if they were going to include as legal legitimate languages for the state, another 16 indigenous languages from mm-hmm. there. And of course they held the referendum on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and if any of the, let's say, the indigenous Maya people wanted to vote in this, they had to go back to their hometowns, which were usually 5, 6, 7 hours drive from the capital city, and of course their employers didn't give them the day off to go and vote.
We do some similar things in the US actually to prevent people from voting. That sounds oddly familiar.
But that was the thing. I mean, that was the thing. You know, there was a suspicion by, let's say, the European or Ladino classes of mm-hmm. the indigenous, and they did everything possible to stop and prevent the indigenous languages becoming official national languages. And I've never forgotten that. And that's kind of 1998, 1999,
right,
when I was a young
co-reporter.
I was teaching in a bilingual school in Guatemala. So I think it was fascinating that, and of course, you know, the modern medicine is not something that's understood in these communities,
right,
communities and so on and so forth. And there's that big fear, and that it was always been running in Guatemala, that the doctors are going to steal the organs and sell them off to white families, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so it's important. Now, if you take a lightweight anecdote. We had a lady on this show months and months and months ago called Claire Austin, who's English, and she had her baby here in a hospital in Fontibon. So, you know, a working class district of Bogota. Her Spanish was not up to much. She's married to a Colombian, etc., and but they met in England. But the doctor was doing his best to try and calm her in the few words that he knew in English, while her legs are up in the stirrups.
That sounds terrible.
And there she is in labor pains, legs in the stirrups, and the doctor's going, "Mouse." Chocolate, you know, and she's like going, "I'm up there," you know.
It's like that character from Anchorman that
yeah.
just comes up with non sequitur. Steve Carell's character,
Brick,
yeah,
Brick toaster.
Exactly.
So, but that's the truth of it. So I think, you know, on the other side of these things, you know, I think that's a fantastic story. When we talk about the Guatemalan story, and well, you know, that's progress in
mm-hmm.
a country that is so racist. I mean, and you know, I live there. I can say I have a knowledge of it, and so. I mean, that is real progress, and that's reporting on something that, as you say, is not in the mainstream media. It's,
right.
it's perfect. So I think this is very, very positive that we have this platform now to report on stories that perhaps we wouldn't get picked up by the main outlets and so on and so forth. You are looking for reporters.
Always.
So look up the website and get in touch with Natalie Southwick. The website's Latin Correspondent. I assume there is a link on there to how to get in touch with you.
There's my email.
Everything's on
right
there.
On the
Latin Correspondent.
I'm also on Twitter.
Ah.
You can find me.
Are you a Latin Correspondent there as well?
It's LA Correspondent.
LA Correspondent.
There's also my own personal Twitter.
All right.
And Southwick.
And Southwick. There
yes.
we go. So listen, this is a good point to take a break, because we're going to come back and we're going to talk a bit more about your human rights projects and where you've been in Colombia and what you've seen and what you hope to see and what you're achieving. But it's been really interesting, this first section, and I hope the listeners out there appreciate this, because it's taken time out of her busy schedule to talk with us today. So it's very nice. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall talking to Natalie Southwick, and we'll be right back talking further about Colombia and social projects and human rights projects that she has been involved in. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here with Natalie Southwick, a journalist, and she's been working in various human rights projects here in Colombia. We've been talking about her various projects, in Latin Correspondent and other outlets that she's been writing for, only in South America. But we're now interested in these social projects, these human rights projects that you have been working on. Tell us, well, I mean, I don't know, you've been everywhere. You've got projects in Cali and Buenaventura. I think you can share some information about these places.
Yeah, that's where I've been a lot recently. Actually, when we were speaking earlier about the article from Guatemala, it reminded me of a woman that I met last year when I was down in Cauca, which is also in the southwestern region, and that's a province, a departamento that's been really, really impacted by the conflict. Pretty much every single armed group, every factor is present in this region. They have a lot of mining, a lot of kind of legal and illegal activities going on there. It's a very diverse population. You have almost even percentages of Afro-Colombian, indigenous, and campesino communities. So there's sort of a lot of different groups at play there. But this woman that I met, she's a member of one of the indigenous communities there, and she had been working on sort of an integrated health system, which was, she was a doctor, she studied medicine at the university in Cali, and had then sort of gone back down to Cauca, to her community there, and was working on bringing some of what she'd learned at the university and incorporating that with sort of the traditional knowledge that they had in the community there, because obviously there's a lot of historical knowledge about medicinal plants, about different remedies that are native to that region that maybe aren't known in these universities where they're teaching or internationally, but is very valuable information. And so she was finding a way to kind of put those two together and make that information more accessible to people on both sides, both for her community to have access to kind of more, we would say, like Western style medicine, and also to bring that information out.
Kind of like homeopathic, naturalist type medicine, but bringing it in, but it's being accepted. The people are taking it on board, or she's encountering all sorts of.
So far, it seems to be going well. She's been asked to be governor of her community. She's been a representative at a national level table here. She's also, I should mention, she's about 28 years old. So it was sort of, I was like, well, what have I done with my life, really? I'm not representing my community at a meeting with the president of Colombia, but there you go. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's happening. This is just kind of touching on what we talked about earlier, that there are all these incredible stories happening all over that just aren't getting a lot of coverage. I think one thing we've seen here in Colombia in particular is that what's making it into the international news right now is the peace dialogues, or the dialogues, we'll say,
yeah.
The negotiations that are going on in Havana, Cuba, between the FARC and the Colombian government. And that's getting a lot of press, and it's important for a number of reasons, but it's also not the only thing happening here, and not even the only process.
And yet the reporting's going on here, but they're not telling, you know, the reporting's poor around it.
That's a kind way of saying it.
Yeah, I've got to be careful.
Yes.
But I have to skim and scan the national press all about this, and you know, I genuinely think they just cut and paste press releases out of the government into the, and so, you know, I don't think we're actually ended up learning anything about it. I don't think there's any sort of investigation into it. I don't know. I mean, you know. But so, important. But anyway, yeah, it's true. I mean, that's the most, let's say, topical thing that's going on. But if we start to talk about good news, or perhaps a bit more creative news, then it's not getting in.
Right, exactly. And even I think this is something that, you know, we've heard a lot from communities in various regions, that the most important thing is for the Colombian people to have a voice in these negotiations. And I think that's something that has been a real struggle. You know, they've finally made this concession a few months ago to actually include victims in the dialogues, which, imagine that, maybe the people that have been most impacted by the conflict should be the ones that are contributing to negotiating, hopefully, an end to the official armed conflict. But I think that a lot of people are very concerned that their voices are not going to be heard, and it's going to be this kind of policy level agreement, which we've seen before. I mean, you look at the Colombian Constitution, I'm not a lawyer, but it's a really beautiful legal document. I think if you're the kind of person that gets excited about legal documents, there's a lot of really amazing stuff in there. And if it were actually enforced or implemented, it would be really fantastic. But we very rarely actually see, you know, the victim's law, land restitution, all of this legislation that's been passed and that is intended to benefit the Colombian people, allegedly. Really, we're not seeing a lot of results. And so I think that's something that a lot of people are very concerned about going forward.
Well, having spent 12 days on the dark side in Colombian bureaucracy, my 12-day stint in the public sector, it's a mystery to me how anything gets done through the legalese and the bureaucracy.
Having spent time standing in line in a Colombian bank, it's a mystery to me how anything gets done.
So, you know, I guess, you know, beautiful documents, but interesting outcomes, if any at all.
Right.
But, so listen, so tell us a bit more about Cauca and the region that you've been working in.
So we work a lot in the southwest, which encompasses mostly Cauca and Valle del Cauca. Those are the two provinces. Mm-hmm. I've been actually quite a lot this year in Buenaventura, which is Colombia's largest port city. It's on the Pacific coast. About, depending on who you ask, about 60 to 70% of the commerce that comes in and out of the country passes through this port.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a major commercial point for the country. It's also the most violent city in the country. It's, again, you know, talking about Cauca kind of being a microcosm, Buenaventura is absolutely a microcosm for all of these interests and all of these players that have historically been involved in the armed conflict, and it's very much on the surface there. And that's, again, talking about coverage. I mean, I think that there has been some coverage of what's going on there within the country, at least, but it's similar to kind of what you saw in the U.S. a few years ago when Chicago was having a particularly violent summer, which is a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of people saying, oh my God, people are getting killed, and not really a lot of exploring why that's happening.
Now, Buenaventura, in 2007, I know that Channel 4 in the U.K. ran a documentary called on Dispatches, which is kind of like a newsworthy, quite hard-hitting. I wouldn't say it'd be tabloid or anything, but usually quite hard-hitting. And it really painted Buenaventura in a negative light. I mean, I recall a lot of the discussions of people leaving their doors open at night so that various of the armed groups, so we're talking from guerrillas to paramilitaries to backrooms, or the, you know, the sort of bastard evolution of demobilized paramilitaries, would use them as corridors through the city. And you know, so it was, I mean, really tough. And of course, it is an African city. It's people of African descent.
It's predominantly Afro-Colombian population.
And the poverty, and there's no land because it's this sort of island section.
Right. Well, you're talking about the doors. Actually, what you see a lot is the Bajamar region of the city, which is, so the city itself is actually extremely large in terms of land, but a vast majority of it is rural. There's this whole rural section that's a large part of the province, and then the urban section is an island.
Yeah.
So that also contributes a lot. If you think about, you know, this is maybe a terrible analogy, but the Dark Knight Rises, when they kind of trap everyone on this island and cut off the bridges,
yes,
there's a similar sense there sometimes. You know, there's only so many ways in and out, and if everyone is watching those, you're very contained. But a lot of the houses are built out over the water.
Okay.
They're built on sticks over the water, or they're actually, the land has been created by people who have built. One of the communities that I visited is really adamant about saying that they have won this land back from the sea because they constructed the street that they live on. They, you know, got sandbags and they piled garbage and they got dirt on top of it, and it is now turned into this paved street. But it was their work. You know, the city didn't do that. There was no municipal service that came and they built their own territory, essentially. And that's also, I think, part of why people feel so strongly about a lot of the displacement that's going on there. But speaking about the houses, you know, it's very easy for people to pass underneath in boats because they're up.
Yeah.
And especially when the tide is low, it's quite easy for people to get underneath. But there was, you know, a scathing Human Rights Watch report that came out in, I believe, March of this year that really highlighted the extent of what was going on there and resulted in President Santos sending in the Marines for a period of time that conveniently expired right around the presidential elections,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure was coincidence.
Oh, of course.
but there's been, you know, it's historically been kind of, for the last 10 years at least, I would say, the center of a lot of this conflict. And add on top of that, that it is a predominantly Afro-Colombian city. The Pacific Coast in general is primarily Afro-Colombian and indigenous population, has historically been very neglected by the state. There's not a lot of infrastructure. And one of the many really distressing things that we see in Buenaventura is, again, to mention that it is this commercial hub of the country, and Colombia's economy is booming. You ask the government, you ask, you know, anyone who works in finance, and they will tell you that the economy is doing very well. How much of that has to do with extractive industries, I don't really know. But there's a lot coming in and out. It's growing. And yet, the unemployment rate there is anywhere from 40 to 80%, depending on whether you count informal employment, you know, people that run, that sell pineapple on the street, or people that sell cell phone minutes. Vast majority of employment is informal. The city didn't have its own university until about a decade ago, so there was almost no opportunity for upward mobility for people. And so it kind of begs the question of, if you have this city and you have all these people that want work and that need work, and you have all of this commerce coming in and out, and you have this port, where exactly is that work going? Because it's not going to the people that live there, and why?
I'm sure you probably can't suggest it. They are expanding the port.
They are expanding the port.
But that's for money from overseas, right?
That's a lot of international finance. There's a Filipino company that's involved in funding it. And the port expansion is a whole other issue. There's actually three separate port expansion projects going on there. One is kind of the main, the two ports that are in the urban part mm-hmm. of the city, and then there's also another project that's being constructed farther up that's like a dry port, which is also where they can process something like 1 million more containers is their goal per year. And they want to expand to move into a lot of these neighborhoods where people are living.
Mm-hmm.
And people, understandably, aren't particularly thrilled about moving out of their homes. There's one neighborhood, San Jose, that's mm-hmm. also called Sanju. It's about 300 years old, more than 300 years old. It's the first community in that city. And so it's of great historical importance to the people that live there. You know, this was sort of this first Afro-Colombian neighborhood established there, and they want to build a boardwalk over it. And so there's been a lot of resistance, and there are a lot of people that feel that a lot of the targeted violence, which has been aimed at community leaders, has something to do with these development projects.
You tiptoed through that with some very, very carefully, but it's true. It's I would say that there are business interests behind some of these expansion projects.
They're extremely powerful business interests.
Give us a little bit of a background. You know, off the top of your head, how was the population of Buenaventura?
That's also a tricky question. Depending on whether you're talking about the island versus the rural part, and there hasn't been an official census done in almost a decade, so it's really hard to say. People will estimate anywhere between 400,000 to 700,000.
I mean, it's a big...
It's over 500,000, including the rural part of the city,
it's a big oversight of 200,000 people. But, you know, I've been twice to Buenaventura. The first time was way back in about 2000. And then promised myself, that was when I was in the employ of an environmental NGO, WWF, and we were out down there studying mangroves and everything.
Well, the whole region is one of the most biodiverse regions on Earth. The whole Pacific Coast is incredibly rich in natural resources, and unfortunately that's now caught the attention of...
Yes, and I promised myself that I wouldn't go back. You know, it was nothing sort of overwhelming me. It just felt...
I would go back just for the food.
Yeah, I just felt...
Do you not like seafood?
Not really, actually.
Oh, Lord, you're
But I just felt there was an aggression there, and you know, and not by the people themselves. I think the 2000s is a different, another era as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, especially there.
And it was really aggressive, and the authorities were really aggressive towards us as NGO workers, you know, because of course, maybe we're slightly more liberal, maybe, we all know the story about it. Anyway, I ended up getting sent back there in 2007, and I was taking photographs for a guidebook, and as I was taking photographs of the port area and the boats coming in, some guys came running up and made me delete the photographs. I didn't realize until later I was actually they were conducting a drug deal down on the front, and they wanted me to delete the photos that I've been taking of them.
Last time I was there, I finally took my camera with me, and I have, it's a very conspicuous camera. It's quite large.
Yeah.
And I was taking photos mostly of the community that we were in. Yeah. And some guys went by in a boat, and one of them looked right at me and just said, he said, "I don't like pictures. I don't want you to take any pictures." And I was I was not taking pictures. I had the lens cap on. I showed him. I was like, "I'm not taking any pictures." But afterwards, people in the community you're with told me that he's involved in one of the armed groups in the neighborhood, and it's hard. You have to be very careful. Yeah. People don't walk around in uniforms unless they're the police or the military. And so it's often difficult to know who people are. But in addition to all of the problematic things that are going on in Buenaventura, because I could probably talk about it for 10 hours, I do want to mention that one of the communities there that I think it's really important to bring attention to is this humanitarian space. That's somewhere that I've been a few times. It's modeled after the humanitarian zones that are in Urabá, up towards Panama. And these are places where the community has been able to assert their ownership over the territory and to get rid of all armed actors, whether it's the guerrillas, the paramilitares, whether it's the BACRIM, which is the Colombian government's official term for these kind of paramilitary successor groups, is also what I've heard them called, and I feel like that's a perhaps more accurate term because it's really exactly the same people in most places. And this also includes state security forces. It includes the police and the military. They're not allowed to enter either. And so they had an idea to do this in a neighborhood in Buenaventura where they had been particularly controlled by one of these armed groups. And they actually started it. They inaugurated it during Semana Santa, Holy Week of this year. So they're getting up to just about 6 months now. And it's, for the most part, been successful. Obviously, people have faced a lot of threats. But they have been able to really change kind of the tenor of this community. When we were there, there's a house that we stayed in, and it's right next to what was formerly what they call a Casa de Pique, which is a chop-up house, essentially, where people were tortured. And the house was knocked down. They've created what they're calling sort of a space for life there. They're working on a way to commemorate it and to sort of incorporate it into the memory of the community in a way that's positive without disregarding what happened there. But it's about 280 families that are involved. It's sort of three streets. They've been able to, in a lot of ways, push these paramilitary successor groups that were controlling their neighborhood out, and people will talk about the difference. Before, they were in their houses with the doors shut at 6 p.m. every night, and you couldn't go out, and you had to be very careful about who you talked to, and there was just so much fear in this community. And there's still a lot of fear because it's very new, it's a very fragile process.
But it's working.
It's working so far. We've seen a lot of threats against community leaders, but we haven't seen any direct violence so far, and that's something that's really important. And just the fact that people can be out listening to music in the street in front of the house where they live at 10 p.m. and they're not inside, hoping that someone doesn't come for their 15-year-old son that night is an enormous difference in the quality of life. And it's something that is getting a little bit more attention, but obviously really needs a lot of support, particularly from the international community. That's something they're really asking for, is that people pay attention to what's going on there, because that's, in a lot of ways, what helps protect these processes, is when the interests that are kind of encroaching on this territory know that they're being watched, and they know that there are other governments, there's other international eyes on them, then they're less likely to create a situation where these kinds of crimes can be committed.
But and this was all, let's say, the the doing of the people themselves. There weren't any NGOs involved in creating this. They decided, let's make a community of peace.
They've worked with a Colombian NGO. That's the it's the Interchurch Commission of Peace and Justice.
Okay.
They're a long-running NGO here in Colombia. They also were very involved in the creation of the humanitarian zones in Urabá. And so they have a lot of experience with this kind of organizing. They use popular education as a crucial part of what they do. So it was the community's decision, and the community is sort of the group that has to be in charge of this, but they've obviously gotten guidance from the NGO because it's really difficult and people don't necessarily know how to go about kind of constructing this space from the ground up, because it's about asserting the physical space, but it's also about kind of asserting this community space and having people stand together. And that's something that is helpful to have guidance, I think.
Sure. And no, you spend a lot of time down there in this community then, and I mean, you feel, I can tell you, you've taken it on board. You feel a belonging. You see a sense of belonging. You've taken over, you know.
I think that there's an important line to walk, especially as an international accompanier, because it also is important to draw a distinction between who you are as an international presence and the community themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because the role that we may play is different from even the role that a Colombian NGO plays, from the active role that the community members themselves play, really what a lot of the international accompaniers do is they're kind of trying to make it more visible what's going on there. And there's sort of a conduit to other countries and people that speak other languages that don't have access to this information. But I think it also is really important to be conscious of the difference. You know, when I'm in Buenaventura, you know instantly from looking at me that I am not from there.
Yeah, of course.
And that gets into all sorts of other very complicated issues about racism, about sort of assigned value, about people making assumptions about who I am and who I may know and who I'm connected to based on how I look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I think people are able to leverage, hopefully in a beneficial way, but that also can become a problem if you're not careful about it, because you're clearly not from there. And it's important to remember that people are going to treat you differently than how they treat the folks that are from there.
And of course, you can leave.
And I can leave.
You know, that's the reality.
That's an absolutely vital distinction.
It's a vital distinction. And they you know, they remain there in the situation
into which
they were born. You know?
Right. And I think that that's an important part of when we talk about trying to create solidarity. It's that understanding that there are those crucial differences, that I have the ability to leave not only that space, but again, I have a U.S. passport. If I need to leave the country, I can leave the country. And other people don't have that option. And so, you know, it's easier to be connected to these processes, these communities while I'm living here. And that's something that I really need to think about whenever I do go back to the States, is how to continue acting in solidarity with the communities that are here and supporting them as best I can, even though I may not be physically present. And I think so that's something that's a really important part of human rights work, is thinking critically about how to go about doing that.
Well, you know, you've shared almost, it seems like, an intensely personal experience there with us today. I mean, you really have opened up about Buenaventura and the realities there. I mean, I've learned plenty today from you. And listen, I'd just like to congratulate you on that work that you've been doing down there. We need more people aware of the situation in Buenaventura. I think just beyond just the horror stories of the Casas de Pique and things that obviously move newspapers and turn stomachs, but there needs to be the reasons why. And the change that needs to come about from within the community. So the news about this sort of community of peace is very positive and something about which I knew nothing. I mean, of course, you are firsthand giving us the information.
Secondhand.
Secondhand. You have secondhand. So listen, I'd just like to say thank you for your time. time and coming in here and talking with us and informing everybody out there just a little bit more about the realities here in Colombia. I mean, it's, you know, as you say, sometimes it's not all roses, but there are things that are coming forward, you know. There are positive items that we can report on.
And I think that's something that's really important. You know, when people ask about living here, there's obviously so much to cover. It's so complex. But I think that despite what people here have been through, despite this very long history of conflict, that there are so many people that really believe that there's a positive future for this country and that are doing really important work to create that future, whether it's in their house or on their street that they built or in their small community or on an international level. And there are a lot of people that believe really strongly in, you know, they talk about constructing peace, and I think that that has to come from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, Natalie Southwick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. I've been Richard McCall talking to Natalie Southwick here in Bogota. This has been Columbia Calling. Get in touch, columbiacalling@gmail.com, and hopefully tune in next week. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. Thank you very much.